You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, there is a lot in the news. There's some really important stuff, like the U.S. Circuit Court, the D.C. District Court. It's like the federal court before the Supreme Court, one of that set of federal courts, you know, the district courts that are one step below the Supreme Court, and the court that basically oversees all issues of federal regulation. If you don't like the way the EPA is doing something, if you want your smokestacks to blow out more poison, if you want the federal water law, any kind of federal laws get litigated by this court. This court had a 4-3 Republican majority for the first 4 years of the Obama administration. And with the appointment recently of Sri Srinivasan and he made it through the Senate confirmation, it is now a 4-4. But this court heard oral arguments on ending net neutrality. And they're working out right now their decision. This court could end net neutrality. Just that simple. Comcast is saying that as the nation's largest or one of the nation's largest internet service providers, they want to be able to say, oh, you want to watch the New York Times? Well, the New York Times has to pay us a little bit of extra money, or they will load more slowly. Or we just don't like the editorial slant of the New York Times. We do like the Wall Street Journal. So the Wall Street Journal will load fast. The New York Times will load slow. No money involved. We can just do it because we've decided we can do it because we own the internet. This is the position Comcast is taking, essentially. I mean, obviously, it's not those words, but this is the outcome of that decision. Wired Magazine has a great piece on it right now. And the U.S. District Court is deciding what they're going to do about this. And if they rule in Comcast's favor, it will be the end of the internet as you know it. Now, interestingly, you will probably not hear about that on the liberal MSNBC, because they are owned by Comcast. And this morning when Louise and I got up, we listened as we were getting dressed and showering and whatnot, listened for about an hour to NPR. And not only did we not hear any mention of this, but we heard a Comcast ad on NPR. So anyhow, they don't own this show and they're not advertising on this show. And even if they were advertising on the show, I'd be telling you the story. I think that's a big deal, and I think it's something that the media is not covering and needs to. This is the courts basically, deciding, and they're probably going to do it using judicial review. They'll probably say, oh, it's unconstitutional limit on freedom of speech or something, because, hey, you own the internet. Didn't we, the people, create the internet? Wasn't DARPANET? Didn't we start this thing? So there's that. Rand Paul is scrubbing his website of all his speeches, the transcripts anyway, so that you can't easily compare them with the Wikipedia, for example, and discover what else he's plagiarized. It's getting pretty bad for poor Mr. Paul. Paul the plagiarizer. Plagiarizing Paul. It's becoming a problem for him. I wonder how this guy got through college. You know, did he copy everybody else's term papers? You think? Perhaps that's kind of a funny footnote. I mean, here's Rand Paul, imploding in this plagiarism scandal that is extending now to his speeches. He's saying, leave me the hell alone. Yeah, that's, when politicians are caught doing things that get people thrown out of college normally, in some cases prosecuted, we should just leave them the hell alone. Okay. But here's something that I wanted to share with you, and I wanted to get your thoughts on. We've had this conversation a lot in this program and in other places about whether or not we're living in a police state. And I've always taken the position that, with regard to surveillance, the surveillance state, we're moving in that direction. And with regard to the hyper-militarization of our police, we're moving in that direction. But here's, every now and then you get one of these stories that just makes you go, whoa. A guy named David Eckert, who lives in New Mexico. He lives in Deming, New Mexico, specifically. Went to the Walmart last weekend, apparently. It was January 2nd. I'd have to look on a calendar to see when that was. I think, though, that was like Friday or Saturday. Goes to the Walmart, local Walmart. As he drives out, as he leaves, hits a stop sign and does, you know, what's referred to as the rolling turn, right? He didn't completely stop for the stop sign. He just slowed down a whole lot and then just kept on going and made his turn. Police pulled him over. When he got out of the car, one of the officers thought it looked like this guy was clenching his buttocks more than he should be. And the, according to at least one report, there was a drug dog that sniffed the seat of his car and said, "Woohoo!" Now, I don't know if you ever noticed what dogs do when other dogs have their butts available. I mean, dogs like seem to be really interested in butts. But in any case, apparently so are the police from Deming, New Mexico. They took him to a local hospital and asked the ER doc to do an anal cavity search. The ER doc said, "No, I'm not going to do that. It's unethical." So they took him to another, and they got a warrant for this, based on the dog and the cops saying he's clenching. They took him to another center, and not only did they, I don't want to get too graphic here, not only did they put their fingers in several times and find nothing, but then they gave him three enemas. This is where they fill you up with liquids, and then when the stuff comes rushing out, you know, take a look at it, in front of the, in full view of the police, so that they could watch for anything coming out. Nothing. No drugs. They gave him two different x-rays. And then finally, against his will, all of this without his consent, because he didn't stop for a red light, remember, they injected him with sedatives, sedated him, and snaked a colonoscopy tube about 5 feet up into his body with a light, you know. And now the hospital that did this is billing him for it and threatening to sue him if he doesn't pay. He is, as you may imagine, filing a civil rights violation lawsuit against the city of Deming. But this is incredible. And it provokes me, you know, first of all, you know, have we gone probe crazy here? I mean, in Virginia, it looks like Governor Ultrasound Bob McDonald, the guy who was governor, who basically, you know, his claim to fame was that he pushed through a law that if a woman in Virginia wants to get an abortion, she has to get raped by the state at gunpoint if she resists with a vaginal wand. And his protege, Ken Cuccinelli, who totally supports the state sanctioned rape. The funny headline over at DU, I think it was something like, you know, serious vaginal probe backlash in Virginia. Yeah, maybe. But have the police gone too far? What have your experiences been? Have you had an experience with the police that causes you to wonder? Louise, some years back, when we lived in Georgia, they had set up one of these drunk driving roadblocks, which I think are totally unconstitutional. She had three kids in the car and a dog, and she didn't have her registration with her. And the police officer was going to send the kids to social services, the dog to the pound, and put her in jail. And she was totally freaked. I mean, she still talks about it to this day. It's like, at what point? On the other hand, I mean, one time I was driving in Michigan, I was going 80 and a 70, you know, on the highway, and you know, in a lot of states you can go 10 over. Cop pulled me over, very friendly, said, you know, in Michigan we enforce this at 5 over. Just thought you'd want to know. I see you have out-of-state plates. Like, whoa. I didn't tell him I grew up there. But then I'm, you know, your prototypical white guy. I'm guessing there are a lot of other very interesting experiences out there. If you've had one you want to share with me, let me know.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I also want to talk about this guy who shot up the TSA and terrorism and the new Walmart business model and how Bill Clinton helped it happen. And welcome back. Nate Sweet is with us, and Nate, a producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Nate, how you doing? I'm not hearing you. Just
Hello?
A second. There we go. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Okay, so we're going to have a we're going to start out with this topic. I opened the show with it, that net neutrality, maybe it's on its way out, courtesy of the D.C. District Court.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple interesting things going on here right now. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is the second most powerful court in the country after the Supreme Court, and it's loaded with right-wingers, or it has been until this summer when the Senate finally approves Srisunas Ron. So it's evenly matched between Democrats and Republicans right now. But it's hearing this case that Verizon brought to the court, and it's trying to gut net neutrality laws, which I think, as a lot of your viewers know, are an essential component of the American Internet system, and really keep it as an open, free enterprise-based resource. And if the court strikes down the net neutrality, the FCC's net neutrality code, it could just allow big corporations like Comcast and Verizon to monopolize the Internet.
Yeah, is essentially what they want to be able to say is, we're going to run our Internet mm-hmm. service the same way we run our TV service. If you have Comcast providing your TV, and I think I may, if they're providing your TV and you want to see Al Jazeera, you got to pay extra for that. Or you want to see MSNBC, you got to pay extra for that. And so similarly, if you want to see the New York Times, you're going to have to pay extra for that, or it'll come to you very, very slow, if at all.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that makes it such a scary prospect, is, or at least a potential for progressives and even libertarians to get together, is that what could end up happening is that these Comcast could force a competitor's website to pay extra to get up to speed net bandwidth. And, that really hurts innovation. The Internet is such a big source of innovation now. Yep. It could really damage that sector.
Yep. Then our big picture politics panel. And so far, Mark Harold and Christy Setzer are going to be with us.
Right. We're still waiting on another conservative guest. We were efforting Tim earlier. May not be able to show up. But regardless, Mark and Christy are excellent.
And the topics we're going to cover.
We are going to cover, it's election day. So we're going to cover a bunch of topics related to election. We'll be, elections across the country. We'll be talking about Amendment 66 in Colorado, which is a tax overhaul, which will sort of it will be a nice strike against the property tax oriented funding of public schools. So that's what's going on in Colorado. We'll also be talking about two ballot measures in Boulder that are connected to that city's effort to municipalize its power, i.e. the city is actually trying to take over its power from the utility and push it to use more
power to the people.
Exactly. Literally, power to the people. We'll also be talking about the Virginia governor's race and how, it could represent the death of the far right and the changing and how the Republican Party is going to change over the next few years. We'll also be talking about voter ID. In Texas, a lot of people will be facing new voter suppression laws this election today. And we'll be talking about the a New Jersey measure to raise the minimum wage and how it connects to the welfare economy the Walmart welfare economy that Clinton helped create.
Yeah, and not just Clinton, but the Republicans during the Clinton administration was this whole welfare reform thing. Excellent, and then we had a Green Report with Emin Ryan.
Yep,
Dublin, Ireland.
One of the people to help push through a carbon tax in Ireland.
Right, right. We recorded that just an hour or so ago, so I know what's going to happen there. It'll be a great segment tonight, though.
It will be.
Nate Sweet. Thank you, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And, I raised the issue, have the police gone too far? I mean, I think that there's little doubt that subjecting a guy to 8 anal searches, 2 x-rays, and a colonoscopy, sedating him against his will, all starting with having failed to fully stop for a stop sign, qualifies as over the line. But, have we gone even farther than that? I remember I was during the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. Myself and a friend of mine were sitting in an outdoor restaurant in downtown Minneapolis, and there was a young man who walked, and there was this phalanx of police. There was 30, 40, 50 police officers who were dressed like the Mutant Ninja Turtles, full battle regalia, something out of Star Wars. And this kid walks by with a backpack on, long-haired young guy. By young, I mean probably 19, 20, something like that. And we're, I mean, this is downtown. It's, we're in a nice restaurant. And in fact, it's interesting. We were in the kind of, you know, you get the fancy salad with the pears and the walnuts on it kind of restaurant. And on the other side of the street was a bar, a sports bar, with beer and wings. And there was outside seating there too. And but that was almost all men, and they were almost all drinking. And whereas our restaurant was, you know, people having lunch. And anyhow, one of the cops yelled at this kid, and I couldn't quite make out what the police officer said to him, but the kid started running, and he ran toward us. And about five cops break out and chase this kid, tackle him to the ground. And the cop at the top of this kid's body grabs his hair and smashes his face against the sidewalk a couple of times. And Jan and I are sitting here looking at this going, oh, my God. I mean, people in the restaurant were standing up to see what was going on. It was happening 20 feet from us. And as the police officer gets, or the police officers get this kid up and handcuff him and, you know, he's to take him off, the beer drinking guys on the other side of the street break into applause. And over on our side of the street, we were all like horrified, which I think says something about this country. It was a very interesting experience. And then, you know, another question that I'd like to raise, and I think this is a really interesting one. You've got this guy who, imagine somebody goes into an airport and starts shooting it up, who is Muslim. And they say they're shooting the airport up because they don't like the TSA and they don't like Janet Napolitano, who's no longer running the DHS, but nobody told this guy. And that, you know, our government needs to change. We need to change our government because we're becoming socialist, New World Order. I mean, this is anti-government stuff, right? Killing representatives of the government. He killed one in particular, a fellow by the name of Gerardo I. Hernandez, a TSA screener. And my experiences with the TSA, by the way, have been fairly uniformly positive. In fact, on a number of occasions, I've had TSA officers recognize me and say nice things to me. That, of course, skews it, I suppose. You know, they're not going to treat you badly, generally, if they know that you're in the media, I would think. But I think I shared this on the air the other day. I travel a fair amount, and in fact, next week and the week after, because we've got this new book out, The Crash of 2016, it's just out. And next week and the following week, I'm going to be doing book tour. I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling and going through a lot of airports. And but anyhow, I was going through the airport the other week, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and the woman who checks your ID before you get into the TSA line, which is kind of the beginning of your experience with the TSA, was a woman wearing a hijab, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, you know, the Muslim headdress. And I thought, isn't that cool? I mean, not only are they not profiling people like that, but they have one working for them. And years ago, I told this story back when it happened, and I think I've mentioned it since then. Years ago, there was a TSA guy in Portland who was a Sikh, and, you know, he listened to our radio program, and we met, and he said, hey, you want to get together and have lunch? And he was taking his lunch hour, so we had lunch together in the airport, you know, with the TSA guy with the turban on. And it's like, boy, this is about as good as it gets. You know, we've got there's a lot of diversity in the TSA, and you know, generally decent people. I know it's very fashionable to pick on them. It's very fashionable, I suppose, to pick on the police. But the TSA are not armed. And there is this debate about now on the right, by and large, about whether we should be putting weapons in the hands of all the TSA officers. And I say no. In fact, increasingly, I think that we should be disarming or de-arming, not disarming, but reducing the level of armaments of our police departments. They're over the top. I mean, we got police departments that have tanks. We've got police departments that have, you know, this full battle regalia. You got SWAT teams that 30 years ago pretty much did not even exist in America, kicking in the wrong door of the house on an average once a day somewhere in this country. and killing people very frequently. So have we hyper-militarized, have we hyper-policeized our country? And if so, what are the symptoms? When do we start to know this? Where are the lines? Where should they be drawn? I mean, the police in Deming, New Mexico, for example, who you know, ate anal inspections of this guy who ran a stop sign, including one where they sedated him against his will and snaked this, you know, 5-foot-long thing into him. They actually got a warrant, which would be, for me, the line, right? Or at least before now. It's like, if you get a warrant, okay, you know, you've got judicial oversight. That's the one kind of judicial review that I think is appropriate, is the Fourth Amendment says, you know, no search or seizure shall happen upon issuance of a warrant based on probable cause that a crime be committed. But this seems like it's gone way over.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we'll get to your experiences. See why it all started with Reagan. I love it. We'll get to your experiences right after this. So anyhow, I started off on this rant about this guy who shot Mr. Hernandez, the TSA screener. And I think it's very odd. Had he been Muslim, he would have been called a terrorist. Because he's apparently a WASP, I mean, we don't know for sure, but, you know, his name sort of sounds, well, who knows? Actually, his name doesn't give me any clue to his ethnicity. But, you know, he has not been identified as a Muslim, and therefore he's not being, what he did falls clearly into the classic, you know, if we're going to have a category called terrorism, which I think we need to have in some extreme examples. I think the Patriot Act goes way too far. But doesn't this guy qualify? So, anyhow, Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Talk about my son got pulled over a couple years ago, and he'd lost about 40 pounds because he'd been working out. And the officer, he got pulled over expired tags, and the first thing the officer did was said, well, how'd you lose all the weight? You're obviously on meth. And my son said, no, I'm not on meth. And
because of the difference in the picture of his driver's license, you mean?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, then how'd you lose all this weight? And my son said, Pilates. And the officer said, what kind of drug is that? But that's half the story. He then asked my son, he says, well, you don't mind if I search your vehicle? And my son said, well, yes, I do. No, you're not searching it. And the officer said, do you have something to hide? And he said, no, I have something to protect, my Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search. I then went and spoke to the police chief of Scappoose, Oregon, Chief Greason, about this process. And he said, this is standard operating procedure now for the young people especially. It's routine when you get stopped for a light out or a red light run or whatever. It's standard operating procedure now for officers to ask, specifically our young people, Tom, because you know they'd never ask you and me. We tell them where to stick it. But it's routine now to ask our young people, and I've talked to any number of young people in my town, and they say, oh, yeah, I've been stopped. Yes, they asked to search my vehicle. I said, did you let them? And they said, well, yes, because if I don't, they'll go get a warrant. And I've been trying to educate the kids in this town. They can't get a warrant based on your refusal
right.
to allow an unreasonable search.
Right. Refusal does not constitute evidence that a crime is being committed.
But my point is, this is coast to coast. This has become a standard operating police tactic because the argument is it's not unconstitutional. I said, well, no, it's not, but it's really pushing the boundaries. My first question in this situation would be, and why would you need to search my car? What's your rationale? What's your need? But our young people don't know any better. And right. Like I say, I'm trying to educate them that this is an abuse.
Well, you just did a fine job, Bill, and hopefully many, many young people just heard what you had to say. Thank you for calling in. Stephen in Denver. Hey, Stephen. It all started with Reagan, really?
Listen, for the last couple of months, and I've always heard you say it always started with Reagan.
Yeah.
And I hear you talk about it from a politics standpoint or a finance standpoint, but I was doing some research the other day, and I found out that Reagan, while he was governor of the state of California, passed a law in 1969 that basically said you don't have to have a reason to get a divorce, like a no-fault divorce.
Right.
And in the 1950s, only about 20% of people got divorces, But in 1970, it shot up to 50% of people getting divorced. So I was like, hey, that's what Tom Harbin's talking about. It all started with Reagan.
So you're blaming Reagan for the no-fault divorce laws?
Exactly.
Here's the problem, Stephen, is before the no-fault divorce laws went into effect, you had to demonstrate infidelity or incompatibility, or there were different states had different criteria. In some states, actually, you know, one of the spouses had to commit a crime against the other, or at least an offense. But typically what they did was they kept women essentially as the property of men. And the no-fault divorce laws changed that. Now, whether that was something that coincidentally happened during the Reagan administration, or whether that's something Ronald Reagan was a champion of, I don't know. But I'm not so opposed to that. I think if somebody's in a bad marriage, they should be able to get out of that marriage.
I agree with that too. But the point is just when you look at the numbers of how many more divorces happen. So of course some people needed to get a divorce. Some people had problems, issues that they needed to, you know, resolved, whatever. But the numbers it's just a dramatic increase in the amount of people that started getting into divorces in 1970 and going forward.
Yeah.
Can you take a second, to some extent,
think that you can attribute that. Well, actually, I'm not going to speculate because I don't know that they're actually, you know, how dramatic that increase was. And I'm not an authority in that field. So I'm not going to wander into speculation. Stephen, thanks for the call, though. Tony in Henderson, North Carolina. Hey, Tony.
Yeah, how you doing today?
Great. What's up?
Yes, my comment, I do believe it's time for the president and Democratic senator to challenge the governors in these states like my state, North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, for not opening up a health care chain in their state, showing how they're hurting on the Medicaid, showing how they're hurting Medicare. We're not taking the money. You got some Republican governor in Ohio and Arizona all open up a health care chain in their state. So it really not there that you got to put the governor on the spot. The president needs to come to North Carolina, go to South Carolina, and put the governor on the spot for not opening up a health care chain.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. I agree with you, Tony. I think that if the president really wants this, and thank you for the call, if the president really wants this program to work, there are a couple of things he needs to do. Number one, he needs to get more and more states to open their own exchanges, and he needs to be calling out those states, and he needs to be calling out those governors and saying, why don't you get with the program, guys? Why are you sticking the federal government with all this stuff when the Republicans refuse to fund us to the point where we could actually build this healthcare.gov website, number one? In other words, there's Republican sabotage, and now the Republicans are all horrified about, you know, the consequences of their own sabotage. Right. And number two, the states who didn't increase their Medicaid – free health insurance for the poor. The states that didn't take the free federal money, free for the first 3 years, 90% forever thereafter, states that didn't take that money, they need to be called out, because now you've got a donut hole, which is, you know, people who are making more than a certain amount in some states. In Louisiana, it's over $3,000. I think it's a little over $2,000 a year. In other states, it's $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 a year. If you make more than that, but less than, you know, $30,000 or $40,000, you don't qualify for the subsidies that are in Obamacare, because those subsidies assumed that you were above, I think it's 146% of the poverty level, which would be around $20,000 a year. They assumed that if you were below that point, you'd be covered by Medicaid. But the Supreme Court blew a hole in the side of that. So every one of those states, you know, the Bobby Jindal states, every one of those states that are turning to Pat McCrory states, every one of those states that are turning down the Medicaid money, they're screwing their low income workers. I mentioned earlier I was going to talk about, you know, now I don't want to put this in Bill Clinton's at his feet. This happened during the Clinton administration, and Bill Clinton, you know, bragged about ending welfare as we know it. But basically this process of saying, it used to be either you had a job or you were on welfare. And the attempt during the Clinton administration was to end multi-generational welfare. And so what they did was they said, you know, after 4 years, you got to get off welfare, you got to go to work. But, you know, a lot of work doesn't pay a whole lot, and people could just get part-time jobs. So you can still get some benefits while you work, like food stamps and housing assistance and things like that. So what happened was employers started saying, well, hey, if people can get all this assistance, we don't need to pay them as much. And this gave birth to this McDonald's, Walmart, You know, let the taxpayers subsidize our employees' business model. And I think that that's a real problem. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, we're hearing a lot about people need to be held accountable, and I've had a longstanding observation. I would call it a theory, but it's an observation that when people aren't held accountable, things just get worse. And I think that's what we've seen. I'm in my mid-50s, and I've seen this all my life. It's just the situation, even when the Democrats are in power, they don't hold the culprits accountable.
And I Which think culprits that's are you talking about, Bob?
Police brutality. I think it's true with our politicians. I think it's true with our current president. And I think it's true back the other way. I think critical thinking is pushed aside as an inconvenience.
So how would you solve this problem, Bob?
Well, I think I'm talking about it.
I know, but how do you solve it?
I think we need to stop being so scared of confrontation. Oh my goodness, it might lead to violence. I think we need to be able to confront each other with critical mindedness without having fear of violence.
Hmm. Okay, so we solve the problem by yelling at each other?
No, I didn't say yelling. I said critical thinking and critical conversation and not stopping.
I'm not trying to debate you. I was hoping that there was a solution in there.
Not at all. But I don't think people are held accountable and dismissed when they ought to be. There's lots and lots and lots of good people in this world that will never have a chance to do anything because they're not being heard. Nobody's trying to even reach out to them.
Yeah. And at the same time that we have, you know, police departments that are doing 8 searches of the insides of a man's body because he rolled through the red light.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Brutal.
It is.
What are their names?
That's something that's going to, I think, eventually come out in the court case. And that's the good news here is that, and Bob, thanks for the call. The good news here is that this guy was actually able to hire a civil rights lawyer and file a lawsuit, and I believe he's filing a federal lawsuit saying that his civil rights have been abridged, shall we say. Although, you would think that New Mexico would have something to say about this. In fact, according to KOB4, the TV channel that reported on it, the warrant that they used for all these searches was executed in a county where it wasn't valid, which makes it even more bizarre. 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, experiences with the police. Where are the lines being drawn increasingly? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Free Speech TV. There we go. Bob in Caspian, Michigan. Hey, Bob, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Back in 05, when I moved in up here, I moved out of Detroit because of civil rights violations, and I got tired of it. I come up here, and 2 days after I moved in, I was in my garage, and a knock came on the door. I thought it was maybe somebody from the neighborhood, but it was a police officer, and he just told me that he was just in my house, and I kind of like, you know, wow, no search warrant. And I just walk right into my house. I try to be flip about it and ask him if he brought in any snow. I moved in up here in February. And he goes, the reason why I came into my house because it was a 911 call to the house. And I told him that I did not call 911. And he says, well, if you have any more problems, dial this number, which is a local police. Well, I investigated further. The next day, I talked to a few lawyers. They asked me if there's any damage. No, he goes, well, don't forget about it. And come to find out, you know, I knew that there was not a 911 call. I went back on my cell phone service. They said, Nate, you made a mistake and blah, blah, blah. And I go, I didn't make a mistake. I called up the dispatch, and finally they got an apology to me. But the thing of it is, he was telling me that he has every right to come into my house.
Well, if he thinks he has a 911 call, if he legitimately believes that there is a 911 call out of your house, I mean, it's not inconceivable that somebody actually did dial 911 and your house was, you know, 116 Grove Street, and there the address was actually 160 Grove Street, and the guy just heard it wrong on the radio or something.
Correct. I come to find out that I was believe it was my neighbor further up the street who did this on purpose, but come to find out it was the police, my neighbor, and the city manager at that time. They're all sleeping in the same bed net, and I moved into a town of a little tiny dictatorship. A lot of these small towns around this country is run by dictators, come to find out. So as it goes right now, I got another for sale sign out in front of my house. I'm trying to move out and move out. And my next move is not even going to be into a town. It's going to be on the outskirts of a town someplace on some land.
Yeah. Welcome to the small town politics. We lived in a little town in Vermont that had about 200 people in it. And about half the cars, there was one street that went right through the middle of it. And about half those houses had cars up on blocks. And somebody got a burr under their tail that this didn't look good. And so the city council passed a law that said that you got a $25 fine per year if you had a car that, you know, that was on blocks in your yard that was visible from the street. So the people who had the cars and the blocks organized, got themselves elected to the city council. And they passed about 7 months later, and Louise and I are just watching this whole thing in amazement, you know, because the town had formed factions, right? They passed a law that it was a $50 fine if you did not have a decorative car on blocks in your yard that you were required to. And, you know, it's like that in Kennesaw, Georgia. We used to live in north of Atlanta. Kennesaw is a little town north of Atlanta. It was about 20 miles north of us. And they passed this law that if you don't have a gun, you get a $25 fine. You know, and it's like, oh, come on. Give me a break. But, yeah, welcome to small town politics, Bob. It can be strange. It can be very strange. Thank you very much for the call. Dysfunctional families are nothing compared to dysfunctional small towns. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, they're looking into this right-wing conspiracy theory that the LAX shooter might have been a believer in one of these right-wing theories that you hear espoused regularly on right-wing talk radio. Why does that not make him a terrorist? I don't get it. Anyhow, Lydia in Tehachapi, California. Am I saying that right? I don't think so.
Now close enough. Tehachapi.
Tehachapi. Okay. How you doing today? What's up?
It's named after the first persons, the people that live here.
Ah.
The originals.
Yeah.
You were talking about police harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1974, I moved away from my little small town, which at the time only had like about 3,000 people. Most of them are relatives. And came back 25, 30 years later to move back into the community. And was talking to friends and, you know, just getting back into the swing of things. I started getting calls from family members telling me that the kids were being stopped by the police on their way to elementary school and they were asking them for their papers. And
as in identification?
No, immigration papers.
Oh.
And so I called, you know, this is like my family's been here since before California was part of the United States.
Is your family Hispanic in appearance?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, some of us are, some of us aren't. We,
sure.
As I say, we range from snow to crow, but some of us are very dark and some of us are very light. Some
okay.
of us have curly hair, you know,
yep.
So it depends.
Yep.
Anyway, so I make arrangements and I start getting neighbors telling me the same thing was going on with their kids. And they were stopping them because their pants were low and accusing them of being gangbangers. And so I called the police and I said, we need to have a community meeting. I said, because this has gone way too far and overboard.
Yeah.
And we sat down and had a chat with several people from different parts of the city. And he began by, he was a new guy in town.
He being the police chief?
Over. Yeah, the police chief.
Okay.
He was brand new. Where they were reestablishing the police department because the city has grown so much. And they were expanding, et cetera. So they hire this guy who is teaches law to the police academy in Los Angeles, and he's from LA Riverside, and you know, so his idea of Hispanics, I guess, has been tainted by some of the worst elements in in Los Angeles. And I said, well, you do realize that, those elements that you're accustomed to dealing with don't exist anywhere near the numbers that you're accustomed to. And just because they're Hispanic does not mean they're gangbangers. It's a style. They wear their pants below their ombligo, what do you call it?
Their hips,
the navel,
let's say.
Because that's the style.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't like it either, but that doesn't mean that they're gangbangers, you know. So we had this long discussion. And in the course of the discussion, he accused the hippies that run the coffee house of being druggies and hippies. And then the Veterans Hall is full of Hell's Angels. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, the Veterans Hall is where all the people who work at the prison hang out. I said, do you know how expensive a Harley-Davidson is? You have to have a really good job to drive one of those things. They're expensive. They're like buying a big car.
So this guy just came into town with a whole bunch of preconceptions, and he was judging the town poorly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on top of that...
Did you work it out?
We finally did, but it was a series of community meetings, and we've had to have that in check. Now, I have a nephew who has had... trouble with the law, and he's trying to get clean, and he's trying to do the right thing, but they won't give him a chance. Anytime he comes to visit, they're in my yard, casing the house. One day they were, my nephew was doing some yard work for us because my mother and I can't do it, and he comes in, he says, the police are standing out there staring at me.
Wow.
So I go back there and I ask him, what's going on? And they said, well, you know that this guy's trouble. I said, what are you talking about? He's been here for 2 days. He's doing our yard work. He's not doing anything. Well, you know, he's hiding somebody in the shed. I said, what? Do you know what goes on in your shed in the back? I said, yeah, sawing of wood, because that's where the equipment is. That's where my father left it.
Yeah.
I says, oh, no, things are trouble. I said, do you have reason, probable cause that you're standing here? And we had this really long talk.
Huh.
And finally, after 15 minutes, he says, well, I guess we've done our job here. We can go now.
Amazing. Well, it's good good that you're talking back. And Lydia, I want to let some of the callers in here, but thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's fascinating. I mean, this gets back to my small town comment. Rob in Petaluma, California. Hey, Rob.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
I am now.
Okay. You are right now.
I don't hear. Hi, Tom. This is Rob from out in Sonoma County.
Uh-huh.
Hi. Do you hear me?
I hear you just fine. What's your
okay.
comment? Or?
Well, you're talking about the police state, and the national headline from Little Old Santa Rosa today is that...
You need to turn your radio or TV down.
They just shot a 13-year-old kid that was walking down the street with a toy gun. And according to the eyewitnesses, he got less than 5 to 10 seconds to respond to whatever the cops yelled at him before they emptied the gun on him.
Yeah.
And it's a symptom of what's happening out here. I ride my bike up Highway 1 every day, a mountain bike, and I found a set of keys laying along the road by the State Beach. So I took him to the ranger station, and as I pulled up, I noticed there's a lot of cars out front, all state ranger cars. Some look like cop cars, some look like four-wheel drives, highway patrol, a couple of sheriffs. I walk in, and all that money that got spread around to all the congressional districts that's being spent on fancy stuff for cops was right there at the ranger station. They had a pile of automatic shotguns, ARs, handguns,
wow,
the maps, and they were like kids at a Christmas party. They were just going crazy. They were holding the guns up, looking at them. They were clicking them and
amazing,
laughing. And
Rob, thanks for sharing the story. We're out of time here, but thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The stunning collapse of infrastructure spending in one chart. This is Alan Pike's post over at the Think Progress blog on the first of this month. He says, the austerity fever that seized Washington ever since the 2010 elections has led to a sudden steep drop in spending on building things like roads and bridges. And, you know, basically, this is non-defense spending on structures. We've averaged a little over $325 to $350 billion in real dollars since basically the Kennedy-Johnson administration. Before that, in the Eisenhower administration, we were spending almost twice that. But starting in 2010, we dropped below $300 billion, 2011 below $275 billion, 2013 below $250 billion. This is the drop is the result of Republicans blocking President Obama's efforts to invest in infrastructure. It has cost the country 3.5 million jobs, and perhaps most importantly, because business requires infrastructure. And just ask any business, you know, do you want to move your business to a town where there's good schools? Do you want to move your business to a town where you can get access to high-speed broadband very easily, you know, right into your buildings? Do you want to move to a town where you've got good access to, you know, a high quality of life, where there's good mass transit systems, good infrastructure, basically? Or do you want to move your company to a town where, you know, it's dirt roads and there's nothing? It's a pretty straightforward answer. Mark Thornton, PhD, senior fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute, is with us. The website, mises.org. The Twitter account, Dr. Mark Thornton, T-H-O-R-N-T-O-N. And at Mrs. as well, M-I-S-E-S. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's great to hear you. It's great to be back. It's great to be on the show.
Thank you. Why do Republicans... I mean, I get it that, you know, ever since the night that President Obama was inaugurated, there was that famous meeting in the caucus room restaurant where the House and Senate leadership of the Republican parties basically swore a blood oath to each other to do anything they could to destroy the Obama presidency. And so I get the political, you know, secondaries of this. If we had been spending on infrastructure the way that we did during the Eisenhower administration, right now unemployment would be at 3%. And I think we can agree on that. He built the interstate highway system. It was a major, major project. But is there any kind of an economic rationale that says let's deprive America of being a 21st century country infrastructure-wise?
Well, Tom, I think you're absolutely right that the Republicans are doing this for political reasons and not economic reasons. When the Republicans are in control of the government at the state level or the federal level, they like to spend money hand over fist just like anybody else, and particularly on things like roads and bridges and defense structures as well. So they're a little bit disingenuous about their refusals to get the budget straightened out.
Well, Reagan put, $1 trillion into Star Wars, into something that really wasn't even infrastructure. It was just a boondoggle for his buddies in the defense industry.
Yeah, well, for politicians, they don't view public infrastructure as an investment. They view it as a way of providing contracts to their pay off their friends and to influence people.
Well, when did that happen? Because there's no doubt in my mind that Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Harry Truman all viewed it, you know, public infrastructure as an investment. Jack Kennedy talked extensively about it. In fact, he gave a speech in which he suggested that we should start thinking of our college students as our infrastructure. I mean, during his presidency, there were still a lot of people going to school on the GI Bill, or at least a fair number. I know that, you know, during the Vietnam War, we dialed back on spending on our public schools pretty dramatically in order to pay for the Vietnam War. But when did this religion, as it were, of you know, if we're going to have to grudgingly spend on infrastructure, let's not do it smart. Let's not do it in a way that's going to provide, you know, high quality of life for people living in neighborhoods and high quality of efficiency for businesses to operate. Let's instead do it because it just, you know, this campaign contributor gave me a large contribution. It seems like, it seems like this really began with Reagan. I mean, you know, that he had the Bechtel Corporation. He had the former president of Bechtel, Caspar Weinberger, as I recall. Or was it the other guy who was indicted? I forget their names. Anyway, it's been 32 years. But you know, they started throwing a lot of money at projects based on who it was.
Oh yes, absolutely. This goes back with the federal government all the way to Abraham Lincoln and the Intercontinental Railroads. Two of those roads were given massive subsidies, you know, loans and payments per mile.
Sure.
And they built lousy railroads. And basically they built the railroads intentionally on mountains because they got more money. They built them intentionally longer than they needed to be in order to make more money. And so that was a government project. And, you know,
well, what you're describing is private for-profit exploitation of government money. Lincoln desperately needed the railroads in order to get war material around the country to fight the Civil War. So he turned to private contractors, and they screwed him. I mean, that's going on today, too.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Look at your private prison industry. Look at your private defense industry. Look at the NSA has subcontracted out 70% of their budget. Now, all of a sudden, you got all these defense contractors, these spying contractors saying, we need to spy on everybody on the earth twice.
Oh, I know. It's just amazingly awful.
So how do we change this paradigm? You know, you on the right, me on the left. How do we change this paradigm from whoever pays the politicians the most gets the favors to a rational discussion in which we may disagree about what is critical infrastructure, but at least a rational discussion that's based in policy rather than buddies? I mean, is this all the consequence of the Supreme Court saying that money is the same thing as speech?
Oh, yes, in part, that definitely is the case. But corporate money is going to get its way into politics one way or the other. There's very little you can do without abridging the right of free speech to prevent corporations.
But why should a corporation have the right of free speech?
Well, that's a legal issue that I can't address. But, you know, the problem is the bigger the amount of resources that government has at its disposal, the more power it has, the more the ability to regulate business, the more money is going to come from business to influence politicians to make things go their way.
No, I understand that, and I understand that it becomes very dysfunctional. And you know, on my side, I'd say, you know, let's get the money out of government. Let's stop the revolving door. Let's stop the buying of politicians. And on your side, you'd say, let's just get the money out of government so that they don't, you know, the temptation isn't there. But I would say, doesn't that create a power vacuum? I mean, if you're going to say that government, for example, can't regulate the Koch brothers' refineries, they can't regulate how much air is coming out of the smokestack, how do you do it?
Well, you can do it through the private sector. You can do it through the private court system, through the old.
But then you've got to prove a harm. You've got to wait until they kill somebody.
Well, I mean, these problems still go on with extensive government regulation. You know, the BP oil rig was extensively regulated, and it was given the incentive to drill in the worst possible location rather than, you know, closer to shore, where it would be easier to prevent those kind of spills and easier to clean them up. They were regulated away from shore into these very deep wells that were impossible to control forever. I mean, they can.
But that's not a reason to not have regulations. That's a reason not to have stupid regulations.
Well, Tom, I've been looking at regulations my entire career. I was in regulating banks here in Alabama. I've studied regulations, everything from drug laws to banking regulations. And it's very, very difficult to make smart regulations.
Yeah, it is. I'm sure it is. And Mark, we'll have to leave it on that point of agreement. Mark Thornton, senior fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Stick around. Hang on just a second, Mark.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He always steps on me. Mises, M-I-S-E-S.org. Mark, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure, Tom. I look forward to being back on your program.
Thank you. Good talking with you. Thank you. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Some days I miss Peter Ferraro. He would have started yelling at me. But, hey, I got my regulations. Oh, me. Anyway. Joe in Lake Elsinore, California. Hey, Joe, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today? Joe? You get the volume turned up? Joe is watching his TV instead of... Well, we've got somebody... screening our call today who's not in the habit of telling everybody, so I'll do it. When you get put on hold, there's a 9-second immediate delay that's built into our equipment. That's an obscenity delay. If somebody says a bad word, we can bleep it. But then also, if you're watching on television, there's probably another 10 or 20 second delay from the time that it takes us to get the video signal from here in Washington, D.C. to Denver, where it goes up on the satellite. And then that satellite has to bounce it back down to your house. And even though all that stuff theoretically happens at the speed of light, there is a time delay in there. So when you're put on hold, listen to the phone, because that's real time. Don't watch the TV. Don't listen to the audio on the TV. Don't listen to the radio. Joe, you want to try that again? No, I guess not. Okay, how about Rex in Magnolia, Delaware? Hey, Rex, watching Free Speech TV? Are you there?
Yes, Tom. Hi, it's actually Rick.
Oh, Rick. I'm sorry. What's up, Rick?
Hey, a real quick comment and a question. I think Siri has lost a great intellectual asset, but also a financial asset when you're not on that 3 o'clock slot, which I really miss. And my question is this. I really appreciate when you talk about Alexander Hamilton's 10 points to bringing back the middle-class manufacturing base.
Mm-hmm.
Can you quick tell me and maybe your listeners about, is there maybe one or two laws that were passed by Congress and signed by the president that could really turn this back a 180 and start bringing some of those, whether it's retail, clothing line, whether it's toys, other things that used to be made in this country that are now made in China, Indonesia, right, and things like that. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. All right. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. I wrote a chapter and an introduction about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. And I get into it somewhat in the new book, The Crash of 2016. Basically, you know, I've gone from saying, here's what we should do, Rebooting the American Dream came out before the last election, to now we've got a new election, to basically saying, okay, we've blown it. You know, we've just totally blown it. And so we've got to figure out, you know, how are we going to get through the crash that's going to come, is why I wrote The Crash of 2016. But what I'm recommending there is that after that crash, when we start building our country back, putting our country back together again, and we're asking the question of ourselves, how do we do it? How do we make this country work? You know, do we look at Sweden? Do we look at England? Do we look at Argentina? Do we look, you know, where is the example of how to make America work? And the example is America. All we need to do is go back to the era before the Reagan administration. Back when the average import tariff on things into the United States was 30%, got as high as 35% during the Great Depression. Smoot-Hawley kicked it up almost 2 points. It wasn't a big deal. It didn't cause the Great Crash or anything like that. It happened long after the crash. But go back to a protectionist trade policy where you say, if you want to make something in the United States, great. If you want to make it overseas, we're not going to stop you. But when you bring that into the United States, we're going to tax it. And by the way, if you're going to bring foreign workers into this country, well, we're just not going to let you do that. You know, you've got to find and hire Americans. And if you can't find and hire Americans, then participate in a program to educate them, like the unions used to do with machine workers. Okay. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And There was an amazing moment. Jim, I'm going to get to this video. There was just an absolutely amazing moment where, and this is just like so to the point, where Senator Tom Harkin, the Democrat from Iowa, it's hard to imagine Iowa has a Democrat as a senator. But in any case, I will also say Steve King. Tom Harkin was kind of reflecting on all these people who are going, and you'll hear them on right-wing talk radio constantly. You see it on Fox News all the time. Why do I have to pay for health insurance for women for maternity care? I'm not a woman. Or I'm past my childbearing years, or I have no intention of having babies. Why do I have to, I'm a man. Why do I have to pay for women's birth control pills? And Tom Harkin had an answer to this that I think was so spot on that it's worth playing. It was only a minute. He was on the floor of the Senate. Here he is, Senator Tom Harkin.
I must say that there was a story the other day about in the paper about somebody said, well, gee, now I have to take this policy that covers maternity care. But my wife and I aren't having any more children. I don't know if they were older or something like that. Why should I have to have a policy that covers maternity care? And I got to thinking about that. I thought, well, you know what? Maybe because my wife and I don't have any more children and they're growing up, maybe I shouldn't have to pay property taxes to pay for my local schools. Huh? Not my kids there anymore. Why should I worry about it? Maybe only the people that have kids that go to the public school ought to pay for it. No, we're better than that in this country. We're talking about being a part of our society. It's to our benefit, my wife and I, to pay our property taxes, to support our local schools, because that's our next generation. We want them well taught. We want good paid teachers. Well paid teachers. Same way with health care. It is a value.
It should be a right. It is a valuable piece of our commons, essentially, is what Tom Harkin was saying. And frankly, this is why I think health care should be a right and not a privilege. And we're moving in that direction. And I think when enough people are covered and everybody gets it, hey, and these Republican governors that are turning down Medicaid expansion get shamed into allowing poor people in their states to actually have free health care, that you're going to see the idea that health care is a right and not a privilege pick up. So, Charles in Opa-locka, California. Hey, Charles, what's up? Charles? Charles is gone. Okay, Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
I have a question for you, but first I want to get the facts right about President Clinton's record.
Sure.
He did not create a welfare economy, but what he did create was 22 million jobs and a balanced budget and a budget surplus and a higher minimum wage and more solar and wind investment and, less air pollution.
He did all those things. You're right.
But what
the earned income tax credit is a piece of this. This came about in the 1970s. But in 96, there was this omnibus welfare reboot. They radically changed the rules for what was then called welfare. And Bill Clinton said, welfare as we know it is gone. We have ended welfare as we know it. And what he did was he set up a program where people could work and get welfare. It had always been that way to some extent. But this got expanded. And the consequence of this was that an unintended consequence. I don't think Bill Clinton is the bad guy in this story. But the unintended consequence was that the Walmarts of the world, the McDonald's of the world said, we don't have to raise our wages as inflation goes up and as productivity goes up like we've traditionally done. We can keep the wages low and flat because those people will increasingly qualify for these public assistance programs. And thus, it costs all of us $1 million for every Walmart in America, more or less. We're paying tens of thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds, maybe millions of dollars to subsidize a local McDonald's because the people who work there also qualify for food stamps and heating assistance and housing assistance and Medicaid, and all of those things are paid for by taxpayers.
Right, right. Yeah, that's all true. But that was done by the Republicans in Congress. They took over Congress. You know,
I know, Newt Gingrich.
Right, Newt Gingrich, exactly. Yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton, he went along with the people. He looked at it like the people voted for Republicans. Okay, if they want to make that mistake, I'll work with them. I got to do something. You know, he's not like Boehner.
Right.
But, you know, anyway, that was most of the Republicans. But my question is, why don't you use Bill Clinton's excellent economic record to prove that Reaganomics and Republicanomics is a fraud? I mean, Reagan cut taxes on multimillionaires, caused a recession and a stock market crash.
Okay.
Bill Clinton raised taxes on multimillionaires, had the largest economic expansion in history. Then Bush came along, cut taxes on multimillionaires, destroyed the economy again. And then President Obama came along, Keynesian economics, you know, saved Chrysler, Ford, cash for clunkers. You know, he did a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And got the economy going again. So
yeah.
it proves that Republicanomics is a fraud.
You're right. And these are all excellent examples. The reason that I don't go to them as readily or as rapidly as I go to FDR is because these were more tinkering around the edges. We have not, we are still, even through Bill Clinton's presidency, which was also based to some extent on a bubble, you'll recall, the stock, you know, the tech bubble. And that basically since Reagan, we've had a different economic paradigm. As long as the top income tax rate is below 50%, as long as corporations are paying less than 15% of the cost of government, we are going to continue to have these boom and bust cycles. But, you know, yes, you're right that what Obama and Clinton did, I mean, Clinton left a surplus and George Bush threw us into a deficit. You're right. It repudiates their policy. We need to acknowledge that and go a step beyond. Paul, you know, thanks for keeping me honest. I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. And thanks for watching in South Lyon, Michigan. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And great collection of talking points there, Paul. If you want to post them over on our website, I will quote them more frequently. The good, the bad, and the very, very mundificantly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, North Dakota Democrats. Oil spills are a dangerous threat to public health, but under North Dakota law, state regulators don't have to notify the public if there's been a spill. Our Friday state Democrats are trying to change that. Right now, they're putting together a bill that would require state officials to let the public know about every oil spill in the state, no matter the size. The government should not be in the business of protecting the fossil fuel industry from public scrutiny. Good on North Dakota Dems for trying to keep their state up to date about what corporations are doing to the environment. The bad. Jessica Black. The Craigsville, Virginia mom finds herself in the middle of controversy this week after she dressed up her 7-year-old son as a Ku Klux Klan member for Halloween. Dressing up your kid as something as offensive as a KKK hood won't get you anything in the way of popularity, but Mrs. Black is not doing much to help her cause. She's defending her son's costume as a family tradition and told the New York Daily News she supports the KKK's stance because it's supposed to be white with white, black with black, man with woman. You know, I think it's safe to say that when Jessica Black says family tradition, she means racism and homophobia. And the very, very ugly Carlos Vesquez, the University of California Irvine security guard, has been placed on leave after CBS2 Los Angeles reported on his racist and hateful social media presence for local television. Here's a clip for that report.
The pictures are frightening. Swastikas, a child with a Hitler haircut, and photos of African Americans with comments that are painful.
Mammy, when is daddy coming home from prison? I miss seeing him beat you.
It really hurts. Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
University of California at Irvine student Vanessa Cuffey is hurt.
It just ruined my whole day.
shocked to find out just who posted these pictures on the internet.
He works here?
That's right. 31-year-old Carlos Vasquez, with a badge and uniform, works as a parking officer at UCI.
Really? This guy is supposed to make people feel safe? That's very, very ugly. It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Just a quick heads up. Events coming up in Chicago on Thursday, the 14th of November, at 7 p.m. I'll be at the Frugal Muse doing a book signing with my new book, The Crash of 2016. In Minneapolis on November 16th at the Engineers Hall in Minneapolis. That of all the events, of all these book signings, that's the one where you've got to buy a ticket to get there. The ticket, by the way, the cost of the ticket includes a free book plus food and beverages. So go to am950radio.com for information on that if you're in the Minneapolis area. That's November 16th. In Denver on Tuesday, November 19th, I will be in Denver. That's at the Tattered Cover. I'll be in Los Angeles on Wednesday, November 20th. I'll be in San Francisco Thursday, November 21st. I'll be in Portland Friday, November 22nd. Los Angeles will be at the Santa Monica Bay Women's Club. San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club, Portland at Powell's. I'm assuming all this information is easily available on our website. And if it's not, somebody tell me, and I'll try and make sure it gets that way tonight. Washington, D.C., Tuesday, December 3rd at Politics and Prose. And so that's our book signing gigs that are coming up. And like I said, if you just get over to TomHartmann.com, you should be able to easily find all that information. Mark in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Mark, you wanted to talk about police officers and this police violence or this culture of, you know, hyper policing or whatever. I don't have a word for it right now.
Yeah, Tom, I'm in Chicago, but I'm working with a group of activists and legislators in Wisconsin who are they've actually created a law which is now in committee, which would mandate independent review of any officer-involved fatality. And it's historic legislation, and
I thought that was always the case. I thought if somebody was killed by a police officer, there was a mandatory, just like that was just a nationwide policy. You mean in Wisconsin, it's not the law?
Across the country, it's not the law. In fact, in most towns and cities, when someone loses their life in police custody or is shot by a police officer, it's reviewed by Internal Affairs. In the department in which it happens.
So the police department investigates itself.
Exactly.
And that's it.
Usually, yes. And in cases where there's questions, it bumps to the district attorney. But as most of us know, the district attorney is really the top cop in that area.
Right.
And there tend to be reciprocal relationships between DAs and police. And so you get this, closed circuit.
Amazing.
And,
so you're working to change that in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a bill that's in committee now. It's called AB as in boy, 409, and listeners can go to ab409.com or change.org, AB409, and find out more. And, it's in committee now, and we're hoping it goes to a vote, and we think it could be a model for the country.
Great. Well, good on you, Mark. Thank you for that, and thanks for your activism related to that. I appreciate it. John in Packwood, Washington. Hey, John, thanks for watching. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I was watching you on the news, and I was hearing your reports of the radiation increases.
Yeah, we're doing these every – for people who don't hear our newscasts at the top and bottom of the hour, which is, a lot of the folks who are – if you listen on radio, for example, you probably hear local news, which is fine with us. In fact, it's a good thing, I think. But we're every day quoting the radcast.org numbers. And so apropos of what you're speaking of, and then I'll shut up and let you talk, but – just so everybody's on the same page.
Research.
Yeah.
One of those Fukushima reactors, the number three was actually to operate with mixed oxide fuels, which means it would have plutonium and uranium, fissionable uranium-235 in it.
Right.
And I was wondering if they were just looking at the radiation counts, or if they've actually been trying to detect the various radionuclides that could be floating around producing this background radiation.
It's a great question. Radcast.org is basically a volunteer network across the United States of people who just, they go to radcast.org and invest a couple $100 on a Geiger counter and keep track of the radiation in their local area and report it on the website. And they are trying to, I guess, crowdsource the amount of money necessary to buy a the word is escaping me right now, but these fancy, I think it's called a spectrophotometer or something like that. It's a mass spectrometer. It's a device that allows you to identify individual elements. And they want to use this to measure seafood because they're discovering that seafood in some cases is radioactive, but they don't know if it's radioactive cesium or radioactive strontium or you mentioned plutonium, which is probably a little less likely because it's A, so rare, and B, it's so heavy it would settle deeply into the ocean. But, you know, which of these isotopes are getting into the food chain and how concentrated they are. And so hopefully, you know, they'll be able to start providing us those numbers soon.
Well, the other question was particularly plutonium, if it gets vaporized or volatilized anyway, like plants blowing up and being burned up, anybody inhales that, it's a cancer for certain.
Yeah.
I was curious if they started looking for that because it really poses a health, and it wouldn't really have to be very high if you happen to be the person that inhales a couple of plutonium molecules, you know.
Yeah, and atoms, actually. And it doesn't
get off here, too, and let you finish.
Yeah, no, thank you, John. Yeah, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take a whole lot. And, I mean, literally just one or two plutonium atoms, and you've got a high probability of lung cancer or wherever it happens to embed itself. And the RADCAST report for today, just so you have this, Henderson, Nevada, background, no, typical background, depends on where you live. I mean, there's some places where the typical background is 20, 30, 40 counts per minute because there's a lot of granite, there's a lot of radon gas coming out of the ground, you know, high elevations, very, you know, mountaintops, you get more cosmic rays, you know, but average kind of in the United States before Fukushima, before all this other stuff, was typically 20, 30 in that neighborhood counts per minute. Henderson, Nevada, 47 counts per minute with spikes to 69. Tucson, Arizona, 41 with peaks of 71. Near the East Coast, Fredericksburg, Virginia, 38 counts per minute with a high of 58. Kennesaw, Georgia, 43 with spikes of 60. And RADCAST reminds you that they considered an alert when they're over 100. Yesterday, they were over 100, and there was a rainfall going on, and it was hot rain. It was over 100. And I don't remember the city. I think it was someplace out here on the East Coast, though. So there's that. So, Lynn in San Diego. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
What I'm going about was, everybody talks about Reagan, and now, you know, that people want to put him on a dime and they got airports named after him.
Right.
But really, he was the poster boy for impeachment. I mean, when he, the Iran-Contra was the reason, the founding fathers wrote the impeachment law. I mean, that's why we impeach presidents is exactly what he did during Iran-Contra. But the main thing was, I think he was the first president that was duped in by Wall Street into cutting taxes in half. Because remember, Nixon, Ford, Carter, it was 70% was the high tax.
Right.
But if you invested it back into your business, like buying new equipment, by buying new Caterpillars and new equipment, new typewriters for your office, you know, in 5 years you depreciate it out and then you do it again and you keep doing it.
Yep.
And that kept the economy going. But he wanted to give everybody back their money, you know, the big speech, give everybody back their money and put it at 36%. And everybody, you know, will have more money to spend. Well, that was just to invest in Wall Street. It was just for the Wall Street brokers. And then in 1986, he has the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which if you bought income property, like a vineyard, whatever, or equipment, you had to depreciate out over 28 years, from 5 to 28.
Right.
Plus, at all events, and the only thing you had to invest was Wall Street.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm with you, Lynn. He created the bubble, and this happens anytime after when taxes are below 50%. Thank you, Lynn.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is a little late to impeach Reagan, but I'm still astounded that in March of this year, the president of Iran wrote an op-ed in the Christian Science Monitor saying Reagan committed treason. Welcome back. And Sheldon in Hartman, Arizona, or Arkansas, rather. Excuse me. Hey, Sheldon, what's up?
I've got a comment and an opinion.
Okay.
Comment is the politicians shouldn't be pointing the fingers at one another because they got three more pointing back at them.
Mm-hmm.
And my opinion is with the jobs being sent overseas,
mm-hmm.
that the companies that send their jobs overseas should pay the American people that work at them companies, say, a 10-year salary off the top of what they would be losing.
Right.
And maybe that way they'd stop sending jobs overseas, and I'll hang up and let you comment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sheldon. I mean, that's one way to do it, is to say, if you're going to send jobs overseas, we're going to penalize you, and you're going to have to pay the workers that have been displaced by these, people working in Vietnam. But I think, frankly, an easier way to do it is to do, for a starting point, Nancy Pelosi got this passed out of the House of Representatives in the first, back when the House was under the Democratic control. She got legislation passed in 2009 that would have done away with the tax break that companies get when they do, like Mitt Romney's Bain Financial did, where he had this company, Sensata, a manufacturing company. They made sensors for cars, carbon dioxide and oxygen sensors for cars, a piece for car engine. They were making these things in Ohio, as I recall, might have been Illinois. And they took the factory apart brick by brick, shipped all the machinery over to China, reassembled it, and they're running the same factory with the same machines, only with Chinese labor, with lower standards with regard to what they can dump into the atmosphere and the kind of chemistry they can use, and lower labor costs. And they got a tax break for doing it. The cost of tearing that factory down was deducted from their taxes. The cost of shipping that factory over to China was deducted from their taxes. The cost of building that factory in China was deducted from their taxes. And it shouldn't have been. We shouldn't be paying people to do this. We've lost 50,000 factories since George Bush became president. We shouldn't be paying corporations to do this. And Nancy Pelosi got legislation passed out of the House of Representatives, passed, that ended that tax break. So that Mitt Romney and his cronies, and the Sensata company I just described, was one that Bain Capital owned. In fact, ironically, they took it apart during the presidential election. We had Sensata workers on this program talking about how they'd worked 10, 20, 30 years at this factory. They were making a good wage, $15, $20, $25, $30 an hour. Union workers, they'd been with them for decades. And now these jobs were going to China, where people were going to do the jobs for, 50 cents an hour or something. And it was Mitt Romney's company that was doing it. And people were petitioning Mitt Romney, hey, stop your company from doing this. And he was like, no, this is how we make our millions. Screwing the American workers. I mean, this is what we do. So Nancy Pelosi got this passed through the House of Representatives and sent it off to the Senate. And guess what? One of the right-wing senators, I don't know if it was Jim DeMint or Tom Coburn, or I'm not even sure Rand Paul was in the Senate at that time, but one of these right-wing senators put a hold on it and said, no, we're not going to do this. And it never became law. And so to this day, there is a preferential tax break to any company that wants to tear a factory apart in the United States and ship it overseas, not just to China, to any low-wage country. And that's wrong. That should not be. And that, I think, is what is contributing to the crash of 2016, why I wrote this book. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and find out what's going on in the world. Bob Ney, former member of Congress and author of the brilliant book Sideswiped, is on the line with us. Hey, Bob.
Hello, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's going on in the world today?
Well, we have several things, of course. John Kerry, speaking of the world, is overseas and has some optimism with Egypt getting into the realm of a democracy. So that was some good news. On the front of the Palestinians and Israelis, nothing really, frankly, much has changed there. Coming to the big change will be in Virginia with Terry McAuliffe, and that was an election that a lot of people thought that he, on the Democratic side, would simply never win. Demographics changed, and the candidate, Cuccinelli, took a right wing stance, and people changed a little bit in the state of Virginia.
Do you think it's the people changed, or that they just figured out what was really going on when Governor Ultrasound actually, pushed legislation that essentially forced women to be raped with a surgical wand, with an ultrasound wand, if they decided that they wanted to have an abortion, for example, or Cuccinelli, or the guy who's running for AG in the state of Virginia, proposed legislation. That Mark Obershane proposed legislation in 2009 that any woman who has a miscarriage has to report herself, turn herself into the police within 24 hours if she goes to prison for a year. I mean,
way overdone. When I say the demographics change, people are fluid, and they change, and they change in thought, and anybody that stays as far out as he did, I mean that's the way he is, I guess, you know, far, far out, is not going to appeal to a population that is thinking different.
Yeah.
These days in the state of Virginia, it was always a given that, you know, Cuccinelli would win a few years ago. So
yeah,
it's just Chris.
Is there any?
Is no shocker.
Yeah. Well, Chris Christie had it in the bag. He's trying to rack up a huge margin of victory so that he'll have that to coast into the 2016 presidential races. But are there any? Is there early polling coming out of Virginia, or do they keep mum about that stuff until after the polls close? And what time do the polls close tonight in Virginia?
That would be, I think, 7 o'clock. I believe.
Uh-huh.
I could be wrong, but I think it's around 7.
Yeah.
But nothing. We have nothing except the speculation that it's going to be a healthy win by McAuliffe. Of course, they're predicting huge with Christie, which again is no surprise. The only thing was the phone call from Mitt Romney to Christie because of all the things that's been revealed in that book. So I thought that actually Christie will have that to his benefit of how much, frankly, how much, you know, taunting they did of him.
This was in this new book out by, Mark Halperin is one of the guys?
Yes.
Yeah. This new book says that Mitt Romney basically used to sit around and make fat jokes about about Chris Christie. And so now he has called up Chris Christie to apologize or to deny it?
You know, he's called to apologize, actually.
Oh, that's big of him.
So he's done that.
No pun intended.
But like I said, you know, Christie... In fact, I think is going to be looked at. Now, the right will hate him, but I still think he's a contender out there.
I think he is a potential Ronald Reagan. You're old enough to remember, you know, in the late 70s, we all thought Ronald Reagan was the crazy guy from California. They called him Ronnie Reagan. And, no American in their right mind would ever elect him. In fact, Democrats were hoping that he would become the Republican nominee in 1980. Because he was so extreme that he would be easy to beat, and it didn't quite work out that way. And you know, Reagan had all these extremist positions, but he talked nice, he smiled a lot, he came across as a jovial, friendly guy, and people voted for him. At the same time, Jimmy Carter was, you know, serious and grim and saying, you know, we got to face the realities of the world. People didn't want to face the realities of the world. I think Chris Christie is following Reagan's playbook right down to the T.
I do, too. And, you know, Reagan made you feel good. And I can remember people saying, oh, that crazy man is running. I mean, that's what they actually said. And then by Election Day, they said, well, I'm voting for him.
I know. I remember it well.
And they did well. You know, the one other big item on the Hill, of course, is the gay rights vote. And the Senate has voted yes. They had 8 Republicans going for the antiquated cloture rule, which is they can't have a simple majority to bring a bill up in the Senate. But John Boehner has proclaimed that it's expensive and cultures change. We really don't need it.
Right.
Looked at the multiple states that discrimination has been proven exists. But that was his proclamation that basically what he is saying as Speaker of the House is he's not going to bring it up for a vote.
Is it possible the Democrats will get a discharge petition going on this thing?
I think they very well could, and that's a great point, because the discharge position, once you get over 218 votes, and they will have – well, first of all, there's some Republicans that are going to support it, and once they get pressure from their constituency to sign the discharge petition, which they will, there are also Republicans, for example, former Auditor Jim Petro in Ohio, who is head of a committee that's actually going to bring gay marriage to the ballot. So you're going to have Republicans pressuring Republicans on this issue. A discharge petition could very well be a real problem for Boehner.
Yeah. That would be very interesting to watch. Does the Senate bill, I know a bills expire at the end of a legislative session, and I think correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, you're the guy who was a member of Congress, the legislative sessions are actually 2 years long, aren't they?
2 years long.
Yeah, okay. So this Senate bill really has until 2014 to cook.
Yeah.
It could sit in the House for that long, which means, because discharge petitions take about 6 months, as I recall. There's a whole bunch of hoops you got to go through and time periods you got to wait. You can only bring them on the first Monday of the third week of the second month of after the full moon or something. I don't know. There's all these rules. But there's plenty of time now. for a discharge petition on that.
That's right, and it's doable, and it was done on campaign finance reform, actually, by Chris Shays when it didn't pass my committee, so he brought it. And they worked vote by vote, and that's what they'll do with this. This issue will not go away.
Yeah.
This is one that, and especially Boehner's explanation, it's going to cost money and the culture's changed. We really don't need it.
Right, right, which is just, you know, nobody's buying that. I just don't think anybody's buying that.
No.
Anything else happening in the world of consequence, Bob, we need to know?
Well, just wanted to mention, you know, the whole health care thing's back at it. The head of CMS, the Medicaid review entity, is up on the Senate side today, and of course got grilled about the website.
Yeah. Okay. So it's the perpetual grilling while they're trying to work out the bugs. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped and reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what's it going to take to change, to fundamentally change our political systems? I think fundamental change agents, and one of those people is my old friend Marianne Williamson, author, lecturer, activist for social justice. Her personal website is marianne.com, but she has a new website that you need to know about, particularly if you live in California in the I don't have the district number. Marianne, which district is that?
33rd.
In the 33rd Congressional District. And that is MarianneForCongress.com. Marianne Williamson, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to see you and great to have you with us. So you are now running for Congress in what is Henry Waxman's district.
Yes, I am.
Tell us why.
I am because I feel what I think a lot of people feel, and I know that you feel. I've learned a lot about it from you. There's a real crisis in democracy itself right now. We talk about various issues, whether it has to do with the corruption of our food supply or our environment or mass incarceration or income inequality, but there seems to be this cancer underlying all the other cancers, this underlying issue that has to do with money and politics, which has taken us to a point where a government of the people by the people for the people is already transitioned into a government of a few of the people by a few of the people for a few of the people. And I think for myself, as for a lot of people, you get to a point in life where the only things that matter are things that really matter. And these things really matter. This matters to me, and I can't keep my mouth shut, so I'm running for Congress.
Yeah. Well, and you're running as an independent. Now, California has a unique, essentially a primary kind of system.
Open primary.
Pardon?
An open primary.
Right. So tell us about this. Why the choice to run as an independent, and how does this work, and what do people have to have in mind if they live in the 33rd district,
right,
and even if they like Henry Waxman, but they still think that Marianne Williamson could do some really serious stuff in Washington, D.C.?
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Well, I am a lifelong Democrat, but I feel at this point that the chokehold that the two major political parties have on our public discourse about political issues is extremely unhealthy. I know quite a bit about American history. I know that the presence of third-party candidates have been extremely important in terms of the social history, social justice history of the United States, whether it had to do with abolition or women's suffrage or Social Security or anything else. So the idea that there's this kind of lockout is kind of offensive to me. particularly because the things that I find most disturbing have less to do with the Democrats and Republicans where they're different and more to do with where they are in far too many cases far too similar. So I don't want to be beholden to a party line. I think that the kind of new voice, the kind of new independent spirit of the American people should not have to be filtered through any political party dogma. If I win, I certainly would caucus with the Democrats, but I think that we need a wave of individual candidacies, and I'm proud to be one.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders really demonstrated how to do that.
Absolutely, Bernie Sanders, and now there's Angus King. I mean, I think the independent voice, you know, if we can have a few of these in Congress, this will really help our situation. And also, I think that the two parties, in, with their chokehold, help create this kind of lockout of the average American, who not only does the money keep the average American from being able to run as we should be able to run, but also, if somebody's not a Democrat or a Republican, it's very difficult. And I don't like that. That's, to me, a very it's a very anti-democratic trend. As you were saying, here in California, we have an open primary, which is a good thing. It means that whoever, during the primary on June 3rd, whoever gets the top two amount of votes, whether it was two Republicans, two Democrats, two independents, or whatever combination thereof, goes to the general election, which is a great thing. It gives me an opportunity, for instance. So this is great.
Yeah.
What California has done.
I think it's marvelous. We're talking with Marianne Williamson, one of the, I think one of the most significant voices. It traditionally been thought of perhaps as one of the significant, most significant voices in America for spirituality and women's rights and things like that. I think, frankly, political voices in America as well.
You are
at this moment in history, Marianne, one of the people who really gets it. And I'm so glad to see you taking this step. And I encourage people to go to Marianne, spelled just like you'd think, M-A-R-I-A-N-N-E, for F-O-R. Congress.com and check this out. Marianne, what are the issues that you see in need of real transformation that you would champion if you were in the U.S. House of Representatives?
Well, I think first and foremost, we've got to deal with what I think is the greatest moral challenge of this generation, and that is getting the money out of politics, particularly since Citizens United, now with the McCutcheon case that could be coming down the pike. We have to deal with the fact that at this point, moneyed interests have such undue influence, such disproportionate influence to the American people. And if this doesn't get healed, then we're always going to be playing defense, whether it's the chemical companies or the oil companies or big ag. We're always going to be playing defense, trying to fight for our rights. It's just not right. If only, you know, if only financial leverage gives you the opportunity to wield political power, where, for instance, does this leave our children? Children don't work. They have no financial leverage. And so this makes everybody but the rich essentially a second-class citizen, as you so well know. So I think that that's first and foremost, to do anything I can to contribute to the voices in Congress and also hopefully contribute to an understanding throughout the country that this must be dealt with, both with interim measures as well as with the ultimate eye towards that constitutional amendment that would get the money out of politics. In addition to that, of course, we have the absolute clear and present danger of climate change if this is unaddressed. Of course, the United States should be making massive investments in renewables, clean energy, and so forth. But I think, and I think particularly coming from California, maybe I have even more on this, we have got to deal with the fact that we are corrupting our food supply in this country, that the chemical companies and big ag have literally changed our food supply. And it's not just GMOs. It's all the corn syrup and so forth, so the high fructose corn syrup. So I feel very strongly about the food supply issue. And also, Tom, this moral scourge in our midst, which is the high incarceration rate. We have a higher incarceration rate than any country in the world. We have 2.4 million people in prison. We had 300,000 in prison during the 1970s. 500,000 of those are nonviolent drug offenders. This high incarceration rate, an African-American man in the country at this point stands a 1 in 3 lifetime probability of incarceration. This is obscene to me. It's morally obscene. Yeah. And I also feel very strongly about preschool. I think that when, you know, I think a lot of people don't know that, you know, if an American family can afford it, they send their children to preschool for the most part. If they can't afford it, they tend not to. But when that happens, what it means is that the small child who did not go to preschool is already behind on day one of kindergarten. And we have 2 years to catch up. If we don't catch up that child within 2 years, the child is then statistically on a 50% probability track to incarceration. If we don't catch them up in their reading within 2 years after that, there seems to be a direct correlation between how many American children cannot read in the fourth grade and how many prison beds we will be building. Yeah. So those issues are, to me, huge. A lot of issues having to do with education. I think we should have a serious conversation about free college. You know, Tom, we don't even have environmental safety standards in America's public schools, and we know that there are 40% of our teachers and students who are already adversely affected in their respiratory systems.
Wow.
So it goes on, and, you know, you were so kind with what you said about me before, but, you know, anything I know, I learn from you. So I know you know better than anybody all these various issues, but I'm sure you'd agree with me. Until we deal with the underlying issue of money and politics, we're turning into, the average American is turning into a kind of economic serf, and it won't get better, I don't think, until the people of the United States, unfettered by party doctrine, say, we're going to change this, we're going to course correct, and we're going to course correct now.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you, and I've learned so much from you, Marianne. Going all the way back to, you know, in the political context, back when you and I and Dennis Kucinich met here in Washington D.C. On the Department of Peace stuff, back what was that, 15 years ago or so?
At least 15 years ago.
And it was like, you know, why is nobody advocating for peace? Why are we all talking about war all the time? And it was like one of those forehead slaps. Geez, why didn't I think of that? You know.
True. You know, if you have $800 billion a year that you're spending on ways to wage war, and a tiny fraction of that in terms of the resources that are going towards more enlightened forms of peace building, you know, it's America's dirty little secret. We have a war economy.
Yeah.
We have to make a conscious effort to transition into a peace economy.
Absolutely. Marianne Williamson, I officially endorse you in this race, Marianne. Count on me. MarianneForCongress.com. Check it out. Marianne, thanks for being with us.
God bless you, darling. Thank you.
I wish you the very best.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't think I've officially endorsed anybody in a long, long time. But Marianne is spectacular. We'll be back. And welcome back. John in Chilmark, Massachusetts. Hey, John, what's up?
Well, not too much, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show, as usual.
Thank you.
I've been watching the last couple of weeks about this rollout of Obamacare, of course, there's been a lot of problems with it, which is ridiculous. But in the last, 4 or 5 days, everybody on the right has been outraged about how the president lied, and he didn't tell the truth, and he didn't lie. Where was all their outrage when they didn't find any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Nobody said anything.
Right.
I just...
To this day.
Disingenuous for them to find... Nobody died because Obamacare...
If anything, it's the reverse. I mean, Obamacare is saving lives. It already is saving lives.
I agree completely. And on another note, a couple of weeks ago, Bernie Sanders was up on the Capitol steps, and he went on a tirade about the Koch brothers, and he actually mentioned them by name and saying that they had bought senators, you know, actually bought congressmen. Mm. Is it legal for, like, the Koch brothers to sue him for defamation or slander?
No, they can't, because they're public figures and he's a public figure, and that's the exception to the rule generally on slander and defamation, is that if you're a public figure, then people can say anything about you at all, pretty much. I mean, you know, there are some bounds of civility and there are some legal bounds. Carol Burnett did win a lawsuit against the National Enquirer way back like 30 years ago, but it's really, really rare. And beyond that,
it's true.
The best defense against defamation charges is, you know, demonstrating the truth of it. And I suspect that Bernie could probably demonstrate that all of the money that the Koch brothers have put into the political system has increased their consequence and their political influence to the point where you could probably make the argument that at least in a few cases, at least with some politicians, and I think we saw this with Scott Walker in a big way when he thought he was taking a call from Charles or David Koch, and he was just all, you know, slavishly falling all over himself back a couple of years back, that, you know, they may not own somebody in the classic slavery sense, and they may not own somebody in the wholly owned subsidiary sense, but they own politicians in the United States. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely. It's so obvious. I mean, that you do watch C-SPAN on occasion, and when you look at some of the votes or non-votes on anything that just makes common sense, you can see that there's a hand behind orchestrating this whole thing. It's amazingly obvious if you have your eyes on right.
Yeah. Yeah, I you know, and it's not, and let's, it's not like the Koch brothers are the center of all evil. Harry Belafonte called them out today. I think that that's an unwise thing to do, although I call out the Koch brothers a lot, too. They're visible. They're unashamed of what they're doing. Same with Shelley Adelson. But there are a number of people who are working behind the scenes in less, much less visible ways, you know, Pete Peterson and others, people whose names you've never heard of, who are influencing our political system simply because they have billions or hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's the real cancer, not the people themselves. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And don't you find it ironic? You know, the TSA was put in a place to stop Al-Qaeda terrorists, basically. Right? That, I mean, the 9/11 provoked the creation of the TSA and all this stuff. And the first TSA worker to be killed in the line of duty was killed not by an Al-Qaeda person, but by an American, apparently right-winger, with a gun. And not just a gun, with an assault weapon. It should be saying something to us. So anyhow, Marianne Williamson is running for the House of Representatives in Henry Waxman's seat. And if I lived in the 33rd District of California, I would vote for her in a heartbeat. As much as I think that Henry Waxman has been a good and reliable Democrat all these years, I disagree with him on a few things, principally his position on natural remedies. He's, I don't want to mischaracterize his position, but I think it would be not inaccurate anyway to characterize his position on food supplements as being that he would be happier if they were handled by the pharmaceutical industry to the standards of pharmaceuticals. And you can build a strong case for there being some sort of standardization within that industry, within the, you know, the vitamins and the supplements and the herbs and things like that industry. I think you can also build a strong case that to some extent anyway, that's already happened in that industry, and it has over the last 30 years, in part because of the recognized need for that. But that's not, I wouldn't be voting against Henry Waxman. I would be voting in favor of Marianne Williamson. And, you know, which raises this whole issue. California has this primary where it's a completely open primary. And they have, in fact, they had a case of the election before last, I believe it was, where you had two Democrats running in the primary, and they took the first and second positions. And so in the general election, it wasn't a Republican against a Democrat. It was a Democrat against a Democrat running for the House of Representatives, U.S. House for Congress. And if enough people show up and support Marianne Williamson over at MarianneForCongress.com, it may well be Marianne versus Henry Waxman. And if Marianne wins, I think that would be spectacular. She would be one of the very best voices in Congress, period, bar none. And if she doesn't win, just being in the race is going to push issues of great consequence to the fore, which is all the more reason to support this effort by Marianne to be a viable candidate for the United States House of Representatives. So I think this is a really good thing. I'm jazzed. I'm up for it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Part of this discussion of the Affordable Care Act, the people on the right that are saying that you know, the big problem is the pre-existing conditions, and that this I'm going to refer to a guest that was on your show when you were gone a couple weeks ago. Dr. Mike was sitting in, a guy by the name of C. Edmund Wright, and other than being so obtuse, he couldn't agree on a single premise with Dr. Mike, including the definitions of point, line, and plane. What he did point out was that he thinks that people with pre-existing conditions, there should be a public option for them. And now I've also heard other talkers, Michael Medved and Lars Larson, make the same point. Now, because they're saying that pre-existing conditions really don't, they're not really part of the insurance model. That's just the insurance company essentially paying for one's malady. Okay. This raises some interesting questions on both sides of the coin.
Well, now, first of all, it's nonsense. I mean, you know, if you look at the insurance model, life insurance, for example, is predicated on the reality that all of us eventually die. It's just how long does it take us to die? You know, can the insurance company get more money from us than they end up giving us?
Right.
Well, and can they invest that and make money with it? And you know, it's not that different in the health insurance business.
Well, but let's look at I'm taking this in a little bit different direction.
Okay.
The first thing is, we need to start with a list of pre-existing conditions that the insurance companies don't have to cover, and therefore these people go on to. So how long does this list get, and who gets to make that list?
Right.
Because at some point, if the insurance companies don't want to cover anything that's pre-existing, well, you know this too, that as soon as you have anything more than a hangnail, you're a pre-existing condition.
Well, this is my point. Life is a pre-existing condition.
Yeah, exactly.
Life inevitably ends in death.
Sure. Who gets to make this list? But then for them to offload people. But here's the other side of the coin, Tom, is that why can't I say, hey, I have a certain pre-existing condition, and I don't want to deal with these private insurance companies. I want to be on the public option.
Right. Here's what now, these right-wingers are trying to do, Paul, and you have to understand, you probably already get this. They're trying to do with the healthcare system the same thing that they've done in many places with our educational system. They're trying to make the most expensive and the most problematic people put them into the public arena and have them be paid for, you know, by tax dollars in the public venues because they're not the profitable people. And they're trying to carve out the profitable folks and put them into the hands of the for-profit industries so that the for-profit industries maximize their profit and the public sector becomes basically a dumping ground. That's what they're trying to do.
They get to make all the rules so that money moves towards them.
That's correct.
And yet at the same time, they want to cut taxes. So who's going to pay for all of these people on the public option that the pre-existing conditions that they don't want to cover? They basically want to abandon society.
Yeah, and essentially they are. You know, not only are we paying $6,000 a year in subsidies to big business when the amount that we pay for food stamps is $36 a year, the average person making $50,000 a year, but the ultra rich, the super rich, have taken $25 trillion in wealth since 2008 until today. And this is according to U.S. government revenue figures, and they've cut their tax rate in half. It's insane. It's just insane. They no longer think of themselves as Americans. They think of themselves as citizens of the world, and to a large extent, because of globalism, they are. And so, let's dump the most problematic and difficult people into a public option. This is cruel. We should have a public option for everybody. It should be competition to the health insurance companies. It should not be the ghetto into which they dump people who are sick or elderly or injured. Thank you, Paul, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But, you know, maybe the right winger is now calling for a public option for the sickest and, you know, will cause people to start thinking about a public option, a good public option. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, it's interesting. The House of Representatives in the state of Illinois just voted for gay marriage, for marriage equality in the state of Illinois. It has to go through a little procedural hoop in the Senate and be passed along to the governor for his signature. But there's every reason to believe the governor will sign it. And, boom, off to the races. So they become, I think it's the 15th state. I'm not sure, but it's moving along. Here's another point that I wanted to share with you. Republicans are outraged, frankly, for all the wrong reasons. This past Friday, $5 billion, just in time for Thanksgiving, right? Just in time for Thanksgiving. $5 billion was automatically slashed from the federal food stamp program, affecting the lives of 47 million Americans. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that because of these cuts, a family of four who receives food stamps will lose about 20 meals a month. But that cut wasn't enough for the Republicans. They still want to slash an additional $40 billion from the program in the name of reducing spending in the federal debt. Republicans love to argue like the programs like SNAP, the Federal Food Stamp Program, and other social safety net programs put an unfair burden on American taxpayers. But if they just took a minute to crunch the numbers, they'd realize that's flat out wrong. In 2012, the average American taxpayer making $50,000 a year paid just $36 towards the food stamp program. That's 10 cents a day. That's less than the cost of a gumball. But Republicans think that's still too high a price to pay to help the neediest and most vulnerable Americans. And make no mistake about it, to qualify for food stamp, you really have to be one of the neediest and most vulnerable. And when it comes to funding the rest of America's social safety net programs, all of it together, all of the stuff we call welfare, the average American taxpayer making $50,000 a year pays just over $6 a year. $36 for food stamps, $6 for welfare. Simply put, the American taxpayer isn't paying much for social safety net programs like food stamps and Medicare, or Medicaid, excuse me. But we are paying a lot for the billions of dollars the U.S. government gives to corporate America each year. The average American family pays a staggering $6,000 a year in subsidies to Republican-friendly big businesses. And that's just the average family. That's a family making $50,000 a year. If somebody's making more than that, say $70,000, they're paying even more. So where does some of that $6,000 that you and I are paying every year actually go? Or more if we're making more than 50, or a little less if we're making less, but you get the point. Where does it go? Well, for starters, $870 of it. We're spending $36 a year for food stamps. We're spending, this is an average family, you know, with a $50,000 a year income, $870 of that goes to direct subsidies and grants for corporations. We give that money to the government as taxes. They write a check. This includes money to subsidize big oil companies that are polluting our skies and fueling climate change and global warming. I mean, compare that to the $36 that you and I pay for food stamps every year. An additional $870 goes to corporate tax subsidies because they're paying half the taxes that they were paying back during the, you know, back before Reagan, basically. The Tax Foundation has found that the special tax provisions of corporations cost taxpayers over $100 billion a year. That's roughly $870 per family. And in reality, that number is actually almost certainly much, much higher. Citizens for Tax Justice found that the U.S. Treasury lost $181 billion in corporate tax subsidies, which means the average American family could be out as much as $1,600 a year just on that line item. Finally, of the $6,000 in corporate subsidies that the average American family pays every year, $1,231 of it goes to making up for revenue losses from corporate tax havens. This money goes to recouping losses from giant transnational corporations like Apple and GE that hide their money overseas so they can boost profits and avoid paying taxes to help the American economy. Bottom line here, average American families are paying $6,000 a year to subsidize giant transnational corporations that are already making billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits every year. In the past decade alone, corporations have doubled their profits. Republicans on Capitol Hill keep suggesting we can't afford to help the poor in this country. They're wrong. What we really can't afford is doling out $100 billion every year to corporations that don't need it. That's where the real outrage and the real news coverage should be. It's time to bring an end to corporate welfare to use those dollars to help those Americans who need it the most. $36 a year for food stamps, $6,000 a year for corporate welfare. Seems to me like that's, you know, this is a no-brainer. Jerry in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, I'm not in Portland, Oregon. I'm near Tucumcari, New Mexico.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Somehow we got.
But hey, Tom, this is Gizmo, the truck driver that calls you every couple of years. Listen, my wife and I got on the ACA website the other day, and we called the 800 number, and I thought you might find it interesting that we were able to get on without a problem. We had a slow internet connection, but we got on and we got through the whole process, and we found out that the only way to actually find out what your subsidy is going to be is by calling the 800 number and doing a live interview. And they'll tell you right then at the end of your application process what your subsidy.
But you can also actually submit an application. If you submit an application, you will find out what your subsidy is. If you don't, and this I think was a strategic mistake. They should have. Although you can go to the Kaiser Family Foundation and they'll tell you what your subsidy is going to be without having to submit.
I did that. Let me say this, Tom. I did that too. I went to Kaiser. I went to Kaiser Calculator. I went to a couple calculators.
Right.
Neither one of them gave me as inaccurate as by calling the 800 number.
Okay.
And when I finished filling out the application on the ACA website, it did not tell me what my subsidy was. The only way I found out what my subsidy was by calling the 800 number. And at the end of that conversation, she actually told me that my subsidy, and this is mind-boggling, Tom. I don't understand it. Me and my wife, we're owner-operators, and we don't take anything. We've always been proud of paying for our own stuff. But at the end of our conversation, she told me my subsidy was going to be $1,029. And I go, you're kidding.
So right? Per year?
And she,
or per month?
Per month.
Wow.
Per month. And I'm paying, right now, my wife and I are paying just over $700 per month.
So you're getting a subsidy that is greater than what you're paying for health insurance right now. That means you can get a really, really spectacular health insurance plan. And here's the amazing thing, Jerry. This is all done with no new revenue. When they scored this thing, and the Republicans were really rigorous on this, the Affordable Care Act is costing us less than what we were paying before. And the reason why is because there's a law that says that health insurance companies can't take more than 20% profit anymore, or 20% off the top. They used to just, basically rob us blind because you've got a larger number of people in the pool, so the pool is healthier. And because there's all these very specific, rules about you can't rip off, basically you can't rip people off anymore.
Well, here's the kicker, Tom. I asked her, that's $1,029 a month for me. It's also $1,029 for my wife.
Mm-hmm.
So that's $2,060 a month for me and my wife.
Right. Can you find a health insurance policy that costs that much on the exchange?
We can get the premium plan, man. My wife says, well, if we're going to get that much, we're going to get the best health care plan on the site.
That's great.
But here's another thing, and I don't think people know this. If you don't spend all of your subsidy money on your health insurance plan and you have children under 19 years of age, you can divert some of that money to pay defray the cost of dental insurance for them.
Wow.
And if you don't use that money on dental insurance and you have children under 19 age, then you get that money back in your taxes at the end of the year.
That's amazing. I did not know that, Jerry.
It's amazing. I called this out just the other day by going on the net. But I wanted to relay this to you and your listeners. If you haven't gotten onto the website, and I'm from North Carolina, so I have to go onto the federal.
Right.
And I'm thinking that's going to get us a better deal because there's so many people on it, and they're going to be grabbing at those people. So, but I wanted you and your listeners to know these facts. I found them out just yesterday, and I'm not giving you garbage. I'm giving you straight poop that I got off the internet and off of the 800 line.
Yeah, I believe you, Jerry. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Jason in Washington, D.C. Jason, we got a minute to the break. You wanted to talk about the governor's race in Virginia?
Yeah, your earlier person that was running, she was pointing out the barriers that the Republicans and Democrats put up to getting into the marketplace.
Right.
The interesting thing about Virginia at the end is going to be how much did each candidate spend per vote? It looks like Ken Cuccinelli spending $32 billion was the last count. Looks like he's going to maybe get 45% of the vote. I'm sorry, McAuliffe's going to spend that. Cuccinelli spent 20. It looks like he's probably going to be looking at maybe 42. Sarvis, the Libertarian, who's been kept out of the debates through various means I won't get into because of time constraints, has spent less than $100,000.
Right.
And he's polling around 10%.
Yeah, now, and he'll probably poll 4% of the vote, would be my guess.
Well, we'll see whatever it turns out to be. The question, though, is, again, at the end of the day, both Republicans and Democrats rig the ballot laws in their respective states to make it so that they, like Coke and Pepsi, can muscle anybody out of the marketplace.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Jason. It's the American way. I mean, walk into any supermarket and you'll see it. And it shouldn't be that way. And it's that way in large part because the Supreme Court has come up with this bizarre doctrine that corporations are persons and money is speech, and it's all protected under the First and 14th Amendments. It's wrong, and it's nuts. Move to amend.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your thoughts and my thoughts on the news. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Douglas in San Diego, California. Karen Hughes was a drug addict. What?
San Diego.
Hey, what's on your mind, Douglas?
Hello?
You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is Douglas Henry from San Diego.
Uh-huh.
In 1983, I was a patient at the Curtis Kipper Mental Health Clinic in San Diego. My therapist was Nancy Newhouse. I sat down waiting for the appointment. A girl sat next to me named Karen. She wanted me to tell you food and see a battleship at Broadway Pier. I knew her for a week. She was suicidal because her brother was murdered by three guys off Hardin Street in Spring, Texas. Coincidentally, a block away from where my dad was murdered, stabbed in the heart with a butcher.
Douglas, what, you know, you're speed rapping here at me. What's the point?
Here's the point. She took me to North Park to meet her roommate and her boyfriend. Her roommate was Carl Rove. She was 3 days out of a psychiatric hospital. Doctors told her no psychosis ever so because she was shooting crystal meth.
Yeah.
I bet Karen.
Douglas, if you're saying this is Karen Hughes, I just can't let that kind of stuff on the air without some sort of a who knows. I mean, A. And B, you know, if that's Karen Hughes was the advisor to George W. Bush, right, the White House, and she does a lot of media these days. If that's true, God bless her. Talk about, you know, climbing out of the bottom, you know, hitting bottom and coming back up. You know, that's an amazing redemption story if it's true. And whether it's true or not, I think probably many of us have been drug addicts at some point or another. I was addicted to nicotine for the better part of 5 or 6 years. It's tough, tough stuff. So, and then there are a lot of other drugs out there, too, that people can get addicted to. Jim in West Palm Beach, Florida, you want to talk about the guest worker program? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
I just saw something. I'd like to mention it to you. Michael Moore just put on his website. It really looks good, too. It's called the Health Shepherd. And that helps you find the prices of health insurance. It's a quick and easy way to do it. You don't have to go through all the other stuff, but it kind of gives you estimates and gives you a list of healthcare companies real fast. So if somebody calls in and needs that information, that's a good thing to have.
Okay.
But what I called about was I called a few weeks ago and talked to Bernie about the guest worker program, and then yesterday you had a caller in named Terry. And he was really right on the money with the guest worker program,
mm-hmm.
The HB1s and, right. You know, the L1s and all that stuff.
Yeah, and they're expanding this under the immigration bill, which is the one tragic part of it. It's the one part that Bernie objects to it very strongly.
The thing that I see, the way to solve this, a good way to solve this, because your idea is great, you know, but that's like we're not going to see that for a long time.
Right.
But the real way to solve it is have real-time information of when somebody makes a labor application, when a corporation makes a labor application, have it real-time posted on the Internet so that those people that are Americans looking or legal citizens can find those jobs immediately and compete for those jobs. That's what we need to do. If you could get a law passed that would make that information – see, the reason why they've been – over the years, what I was trying to say the other day was that they're taking that information away from us. They're they're making it dark.
Yeah,
making it black.
No, I agree with you, Jim. And this is outside the realm of what you're talking about, but this is something I think that we should do too. In 1935, Franklin Roosevelt passed a bill called the America First Act, I believe it was called, which says that all federal hiring has to be any federal contract. You have to hire Americans first. And they have not been enforcing it since Reagan. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Jeremy in Seattle. Hey, Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just wanted to mention something in regards to what your guest earlier in the show said. Marianne, is that her name?
Marianne Williamson, yeah. Marianne for Congress.com, yes.
I've been in education for a long time, and about 25 years or so. And one of the things I recently read was Elizabeth Warren's book, The Two Income Trap.
Mm-hmm.
And Elizabeth Warren, stout progressive, progressives really like her. But one of the things she came out specifically against is universal preschool. And the reason she came out specifically against that is that if you look at, like, well, because basically what happened, according to her, in terms of the drop-off in the middle class, and she backs it up pretty well, is that, you know, people had to buy up the possibilities for their kids, increase the chances that their kids could be successful in life. And so two parents went to work, and we had this thing with, you know.
Right. She suggests, actually, that the entrance of women into the workplace in the 70s coincided with the flattening of the rise of wages relative to productivity, and that the first way that Americans dealt with that was by wives going to work. The second way they dealt with it was turning their homes into an ATM, and the third way they dealt with it was going into credit card and student loan debt. And that what you can arguably extrapolate from that is that single-income households are better for families than two-income households. Is that the point you're making?
Well, that's precisely the reason we're a single-income household. But what I wanted to say was, if you have universal preschool, that's going in countries where they have universal preschool, they also have a sufficient social structure for young families. So young families get things like Kindergeld in Germany. So money, they get money basically paying the parents to stay home.
Right.
So a parent to stay home. So rather than saying let's give a bunch of money to create new institutions, let's see if we can pay parents to stay home.
Right.
You know what I mean? Personally, I think that's a better idea. But I just wanted to add that. And
I don't disagree. And Jeremy, the way that I would deal with it is, and I've been saying this for decades, and I don't know why this hasn't cracked through into the mainstream dialogue, is that parenting should be considered a respectable profession. And parenting should be acknowledged by the Social Security Administration as having a monetary value. It should be recognized by anything else that we use to determine the value of somebody's work in the workplace. And that, therefore, if somebody chooses that they're going to stay home and parent, then I realize if you say, okay, that's the equivalent of $30,000 income. Oh, where's the income tax on that? You have to have essentially the reverse of that. But what we should be encouraging single parent, whether it's mom or dad at home, I don't care, but single parent households. I think that when you have more than half of all the kids in America coming home to an empty home, which was that 50% point we crossed in the late 1980s, when you have that kind of a situation, it's not a good thing for the country, in my opinion. And I realize that there are people who will say, oh, that makes you a sexist fossil who wants women to stay home and pregnant and with the kids. And that's not what I'm saying at all. But I think that having a single income, my brother stays home and his wife works, for example, and has for a decade and a half. And you know, he's just, you know, one of the best parents, now one of the best grandparents ever could be, one of my brothers. And I think it's just, you know, this is something we should be talking about, and we're not. Jeremy, thank you for the call. And like you say, a universal preschool kind of buys into the notion that everybody should work. Tom in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, you know, I can't believe that I missed the Mitt Romney being able to write off the income tax of moving something over.
Sensata Corporation,
so,
right. Yeah.
Right.
It happened about
like
3 months before the election, actually.
I know. So I would like you to have a segment, and we could call it the Leona Helmsley Income Evasion Award. And that way you could teach us, each time somebody does some outrageous thing, to avoid income tax.
Yeah.
Because she went before a federal judge, right? And she was behind $12 million, and the federal judge asked her why she didn't pay her income tax. And she said, the rich don't pay income tax. The income tax is paid by the working class.
I think the verbatim quote was, only the little people pay taxes. I'm quite sure that was exactly what she said. But, the Leona Helmsley Award, that's a great idea, although it's been a while. There's probably, you know, some of our listeners who don't even know who Leona was. Her husband, Harry, owned a fortune in real estate, hotels in particular, in New York City. And he died, and she was very, very wealthy. And now she's passed on to the great beyond as well. But that's a great idea, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling and sharing it. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, genius brother, think about this for a moment. Maybe this is the way we can get to the real honest regulation that we're going to have to do with the economic situation in this country to ever reinvigorate or bring about a middle class again. We all agree, whether we're left, right, whatever religion, whatever education, that it's important that we have a infrastructure for vehicle movement in this country, and we do. And we also agree, the majority of us, that economics is even more paramount and more important, and the far-reaching effects of economics to the lives of the people, the majority in this country, more so than even the traffic of our vehicles. So then we conclude that we have rules of the road, speed limits, lines, regulations, so that nobody has an advantage regardless of how wealthy they are, whatever religion they are, or where they came from.
Right.
And we regulated highly our traffic for our vehicles, and we have to do the same thing with economics. We have to come to a conclusion where we regulate it to where the wealthy do not have an inherent advantage, and they can quickly move through it and accumulate so much wealth that it takes away from the balance in the social system.
I'm with you, Armin. I'm with you. What you're saying is what Elizabeth Warren said when she said, you know, people think the system is rigged. It is. And you're absolutely right. The system is rigged, and we need to fix that. We need to come up with an alternative. Coming up tomorrow, of course, the results from today's elections and what they mean from the country. Plus, what don't conservatives like about welfare to work? We'll talk with Patrice Hill of the Washington Times. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. And my new book, The Crash of 2016, is out. Check it out. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.